It is often assumed in modern society that religion and technology are by their very natures incompatible. It is an extension of the age-old conflict between faith and reason, we say. But is this actually the case? Is it possible that, over the centuries, religious thought has actually played an important role in the advancement of technology? Could the goals of new technologies actually include the spiritual? With us today to discuss the relationship of religion and technology is Dr. David F. Noble, Professor of History at York University in Toronto, and currently the Hixon Riggs Visiting Professor at Harvey Mudd College. Dr. Noble is a past curator of modern technology at the Smithsonian Institution and is the author of The Religion of Technology, The Divinity of Man, and The Spirit of Invention. Welcome, Professor Noble.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Today in our society, we seem to be in the grips of millennium fever. And in your book, you discuss how the pursuit of the millennium actually is connected to the rise of Western technology.
Right. Well, actually, we're at a moment of irony right now. On the one hand, the enthusiasm, the obsession with the year 2000, and many people seeing it as the millennium from the Book of Revelation, actually without much justification, but that's an association people are making. And at the same time, there's an equal obsession with technology, and this is all coming sort of to a head with the Y2K bug. Many people see the Y2K as a kind of divine retribution for the hubris that humans have displayed recently. The perception of computers and the powers that come from computers as being almost godlike. And there are some, especially pronounced in the United States, where millenarianism has always been very strong. There is this almost an expectation, a gleeful expectation in the calamity that will ensue when the Y2K bug hits and shuts off our power and all these other things. And so we're living in a very interesting moment here.
Now, in your book, you talk about how the fall of man and the ideas of wishing to regain again that perfection that we had in the Garden of Eden was actually a spur to many in terms of early technology.
Right. Well, in the book, what I'm doing is tracing what I'm calling the religion of technology, which really is about 1,000 years old. In the first millennium, the first 1,000 years of the Christian era, most Orthodox Christians held the classical view that the useful arts, what we now call technology, was really a lowly activity associated with manual labor and slavery and with women as well. And so it wasn't really given much attention, but more important, it wasn't at all associated with the main project of Christianity, which is redemption, salvation, recovery of lost perfection. And around the 9th and 10th centuries, for reasons that are not altogether clearly understood, the useful arts become implicated in this project of redemption. So what I'm doing is tracing that story about how the major myths of our Western society, and the West is really defined originally as Latin Christendom, we're talking about Christian myths, and the myths, as you mentioned, have to do with the recovery of paradise. And the assumption was that, among Christian theologians, was that Adam had a share in divine knowledge, that is, knowledge about nature, and enjoyed dominion over creation, and also participated in creation, symbolized by the naming of the beast in Genesis, and also enjoyed eternal existence, immortality. All of this was forfeited with the fall. And the idea, the promise of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, that redemption is in the offing for mankind, meaning a recovery of those lost powers. So in the 9th and 10th century, when the useful arts become implicated, primarily under the auspices of monks, the idea was that by developing the sciences and the arts, or science and technology as we call it today, human beings are restoring, recovering what they originally were, their original birthright, and approximating the powers that had been lost, and anticipating, and this is crucial for millenarianism, anticipating this total recovery of our angelic status, our divinity, with the coming of the millennium. And the millennium is, again, from the last book of the New Testament, the book of Revelation, a thousand-year period following the return of the Messiah, in which the saints, or the righteous, will reign with Christ for 1,000 years. That's where the word millennium comes from. And that's sort of a collective redemption for the first, as in the book of Revelation, for the first to be redeemed. And so, starting in about 1,000 years ago, the useful arts, as I said, became implicated in this story. And again, we see the promoters of technology talking in these terms, that what we're doing is recovering what we have lost and also preparing for the millennium in which we will indeed be restored to our original perfection.
And this pursuit of paradise even extended to exploration. I remember back in 1992, there was that Christopher Columbus film with Gerard Depardieu and, subtitled The Conquest of Paradise, and we all thought that that was just a nifty title. But you make the point that Columbus really thought that he had found a new biblical paradise, and that's part of what he had been seeking.
Right. Well, I mean, just to put the context, put this in context, in the 11th century, there was an abbot by the name of Joachim of Fiore who reinterpreted millenarianism in such a way as to make it historical and to give human beings some role, some agency in preparing for and bringing about the millennium. And he had identified a vanguard, the weary spiritualis of spiritual men, who would, through contemplation and evangelizing, help bring about this the kingdom of God. And at first it was the monks, the Cistercians especially, and then the baton was passed to the Franciscans, especially the spiritual Franciscans, the friars. And then the explorers, especially Columbus, bore that mantle. And Columbus was very much influenced by this tradition, and he was a Joachimite millenarian, which was very, very widespread at the time in Spain. And so he believed quite firmly that he had been sent by prophecy, and in fact explained this in great detail to his patrons, the King and Queen of Spain. And this is where he got his chutzpah, his courage, his confidence to do what he did, because he believed that it had been preordained. He was the Christopherens, the Christ bearer, and he would bear the Christ, the message, the gospel, to the new world. And the new world was, in his view, he called it the terrestrial paradise, the paradise that had been lost. And indeed, many among the early explorers, especially the Franciscans, viewed the natives of these new lands as the lost tribe of Israel. And in the millenarian mythology, the conversion of the Jews, and these people are now identified as Jews, is the a prerequisite for the millennium. So Columbus saw himself as the bearer of this tradition. And it's this aspect of his experience has been downplayed, but it's really central.
How did Freemasonry bring the religion of technology into modern times?
Okay, again, just to carry the story up until the 18th century and 17th century, I mean the friars and the explorers gave rise to a fervent belief that the the study of nature would restore human beings to their original perfection and purify Christianity. And this is the story of the Renaissance Magi and the Rosicrucians. And the vanguard, the main promoters of science and technology at the time, were fueled by this expectation. And this carries into the 17th century, the so-called period of the Scientific Revolution, when most of the leading figures, Robert Boyle, Isaac Newton, were equally inspired. And Newton, for example, spent much of his life trying to understand ancient writings, and he believed that all he was doing was really restoring human knowledge, not discovering anything new. He tried feverishly to date when the millennium would begin, etc. The Freemasons come in the 18th century, and they have their origins in the Rosicrucian Brotherhood of the 17th century. And they carry this forward into the Age of Enlightenment. The Freemasons, their lore is very much in this spirit that Adam, the Freemason constitutions begin with the words, Adam, our first parent. Eve is never mentioned. That's a very important part of the story, too, the gender aspect of this whole story, mythology. But the Masons, the Freemasons, were the main promoters of the industrial arts in the 18th and into the 19th century in the United States. Development of engineering as an institution, the development of engineering education, especially in France, the Ecole Polytechnique, and the other leading institutions, all were the creations of the Freemasons. So in my story, the Freemasons are carrying this mythology into what is often seen, thought to be a more secular age, the Age of Enlightenment.
To bring the story a little further forward, you talk about how even the creators of the atomic bomb would use creation and apocalyptic imagery to describe their work, such as the Trinity test.
Right. And Oppenheimer, who was a Jew, is using a quintessentially Christian notion, the Trinity, which he later remembered that it had come from some poems of John Donne, the 17th century metaphysical poet. So what I'm trying to argue here is that there are deep-seated cultural, shared cultural norms and impulses that are moving us, and we're not very much aware of it. In the 19th century, especially the second half of the 19th century, some of this millenarian expectation was dulled somewhat following the Second Great Awakening, the largest mass movement in American history. And gave way to an idea of infinite progress rather than some end time and final judgment. But with the horrors of World War I and especially World War II and especially the atomic bomb, this godlike power of destruction, the apocalyptic expectations returned with a vengeance. And many within the scientific community shared them and believed themselves to be like gods, wielding a power of destruction, which again, from the Book of Revelation, is a power of redemption as well. That is, salvation through destruction.
We only have a moment remaining, but perhaps you could say in conclusion, you discuss in your conclusion that perhaps the convergence between religion and technology has outlived its historical usefulness. How so? And what do you think is to follow?
Well, what I'm saying there very quickly is the hallmark technologies of our age, manned spaceflight, genetic engineering, artificial intelligence, all betray an impatience with life, an impatience with our mortal conditions and mortal limits. And I think there's a real menace here, because it leads to a disregard for our mortal needs. We can get into our spaceships and get out of here and really abandon the planet to its fate. We can download our minds into machines, silicon-based machines, and move into the post-biological civilization and essentially transcend our mortal needs. All of this I see as very dangerous escapist. And what I'm urging is that we overcome our otherworldly proclivities and embrace anew our earthly condition.
Thank you, Professor Noble.
My pleasure.
We have been talking with Dr. David F. Noble, author of The Religion of Technology, The Divinity of Man, and The Spirit of Invention.